Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com, RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Let's talk. Talk.
John Brown. Spitfire pilot, Flight Lieutenant Julian Zumoski, RAF hero and Nazi collaborator, is a fascinating book by aviation historian, the man who knows more about the RAF, I think, and it's fabulous history during that conflict than anybody else on the planet, I'd say. Delighted to be joined by Colin Pateman. Colin, good morning to you, sir.
Good morning, Giles.
Good to have you. This is the latest. I was just looking through your back catalogue of books on the one about the tail gunners. Looks well. I'm going to go off and order that one for a start because that looks right up my street. But explain a little bit about yourself because you had a very colourful history. Was it the Met Police as a dog handler? What's your story?
It was the Home Counties
right.
Police.
Yep.
I was very fortunate to be able to serve the majority of it on the dog section, working police dogs and search dogs. And I had a most enjoyable, fulfilling and rewarding service for 32 years, which I loved.
Yeah, I saw the website. I was checking your website because I do occasionally do some research. And there's a brilliant picture of you and a certain noble hound, which brought a smile to my face.
Yeah, that was actually my search dog, my Springer Spaniel search dog, and of course I worked through the period of the Troubles where this country was subject to actions by the Provisional IRA, and a lot of my work was involved in security searching with the dogs.
Fascinating. Well, where's the RAF connection come then? Because you think with your police background, you'd perhaps be writing about police issues rather than RAF history. So, what's the RAF connection, please, Colin?
Well, it goes back to really young childhood when my grandmother bought me a comic called the Victor comic. And the Victor comic was an illustrated comic, and it was based upon stories of real interest that took place in the Second World War, amongst others. And the front page always had an illustration of something pretty sort of eye-catching. And that, I think, was the stimulus for me to be interested in what happened in the Second World War.
Yeah, I grew up with sort of Battle and Commando and stuff like that. And, you know, for you, Fritz, the war is over, etc. Completely unsuitable these days, but there you go.
Yes.
So tell me about this. Now, first of all, his name, because I pronounce it as Julian Zumoski. Am I there or thereabouts? Well, who is this gentleman?
You're very close. Julian Zoromsky.
Right, okay.
In fact, his full name was Julian Kazimierz Zoromsky. And it is actually a relatively common Polish configuration of names from that period.
Now, the Poles in the Second World War, I'm only sort of rediscovering because I've been reading Kate Mulley's excellent books on the Polish secret agents, especially female secret agents, including Agent Zoe and that sort of thing. But however, tell me a little bit about, because most people with a passing interest in aviation history or the Second World War will know about the Polish squadron during the conflict. So explain a little bit about Julian's sort of background and the starting point for the book, if you will.
Okay, well, Julian Zoromsky came from a typical Polish military history family. His father was a cavalry officer, and during his father's service of period, there was the Russian intrusions into their homeland with the intent of obviously invading, which was repulsed. I think that gave Julian a taste of sort of military service, and Julian himself went on and volunteered. He wanted to join and be part of the embryonic Polish Air Force that was starting to grow in strength, and he was fortunate to get through a relatively stringent process of acceptance because the numbers were very limited. I strongly suspect that his father's previous military service had some influential factors there. And he was trained at a place called Devlin, which was the national location for military flying. And coincidentally, of course, that was at the time when the Second World War was brewing. And the subsequent joint alliance between Nazi Germany and the Russian forces saw Poland invaded. And during that invasion, there was a lot of hectic times. Julian was a capable pilot, but he hadn't formalized his full training. Mm. And although capable to fly a single-engine aircraft, the circumstances saw the military forces in Poland just squashed, really, almost annihilated. And it caused a situation where all of those forces evacuated to the very best of their ability to adjacent countries, basically.
Here's the thing, I hadn't thought about this before. What are the Poles flying at this point? What would be the regular, what would be the sort of standard? Yeah.
Nowadays, you'd look at them and you think they were pretty antiquated, fixed landing gear, twin wings, fuselage, sort of not particularly elegant aircraft.
Open cockpit, or is
yeah, open cockpit, yeah. And they're very, very far removed from what we might now formalise as the iconic Spitfire. Yeah. It was far, far removed from that, yeah.
So basically, again, most of the Polish Air Force, as you see, are destroyed on the ground. That's the Luftwaffe's thing, Stukas, etc. Wipe them out before they can get off the ground. It's much and everything around it. They go in all directions, presumably. I mean, some will head to France. Julian goes to Romania, I believe.
Yes. They went to really wherever they could seek haven, and obviously they were hoping to be treated as a friendly ally, as opposed to an alien force. And various experiences took place with different sort of receptions. But ultimately what happened was the war progressed. The countries which they had moved to, they were on the cusp of different alliances. And I suppose the best way to summarise it is that with the way that the war went, the Polish forces, in particular the Air Force personnel, saw the only escape being into France, because right. Obviously France at that time was still deemed to be a pretty strong threshold in Europe with Allied forces.
Because again, we look at this now because we know what happens, but at the time France got one of the biggest armies in the world. So many tanks, unfortunately they are antiquated tanks. They haven't built, I think France built three tanks in 1938 or something ridiculous like that. And so nobody can foresee that the Battle of France will be over so quickly, can they?
Absolutely correct, Giles. The British Expeditionary Force was pretty significant in numbers, and the anticipation was, I personally think the anticipation was that they would have so much resources that we would sort of revert back to a First World War holding scenario. But of course, that never happened. There was never any entrenchment. There was never any real stemming of the force and the might and the numbers and the equipment of the German army.
And the other thing, of course, is that they built the Maginot Line, okay? So they've done that, but they don't want to build it across Belgium because it'll send the wrong message out to their quote-unquote Belgian friends. And, yep. And guess what? The Wehrmacht came through the same place exactly with the same Ford that they did the first time round.
Yes, I think it was a bit of naivety. It was a bit of... the Maginot Line was seen as impenetrable, and certainly bits of it probably were impenetrable if you approached it in the wrong way. Yeah. But in the end, it became a very expensive mistake.
So our man, Julian, gets out of France. Yeah. How does he get over to – is he part of the Dunkirk withdrawal? Does he fly over before it all kicks off and, you know, as the BEF makes its quote-unquote organised retreat from the beaches of Dunkirk? Well,
obviously, at this time, Giles, it is basically chaos, and written records are sparse. And a lot of what we work from is historical references. In my case, I was very fortunate to be able to have to hand the flying logbook composed and written by Julian Zaromski during his military service post Poland. What that means is that logbook is a record of service for any flight that he undertook in training or operation, and it was an official document that was signed by his supervisors, by the RAF structure, and that allows me to be very definitive over what I put in my book. But there are areas beforehand where I have to rely on archived information. And the truth is, we really don't know independent routes or journeys of remarkable people like Julian Zaromski.
Because here's the thing, you're saying it's a chaotic retreat. You've got millions of people trying to get civilians, military personnel. And if you are a Polish officer and you get captured by either the Germans or the Soviets, then you're not going to come back out. You're going to end up in a forest somewhere, which we will come on to a little bit later. And it's not a simple case. If you were right, you arrive in the UK and you go over, you know, with your pipe and your moustache to the nearest RAF, the airfield and go, hello, chaps, I'm a Polish Air Force. So it's complete chaos. And obviously they're trying to process people. So how does he get, where does he go next? And how does he get involved with, because he doesn't just stroll into a Spitfire, does he, with the Polish squadron?
No.
Just,
exactly. If we jump back to France, yep. he made it to Marseille, and he was on a evacuation troop with resources which were thought to be beneficial to England. So that would be anyone with military service and anyone of any note.
Yeah.
They were obviously, with the fall of France, Britain itself was embarking on the Battle of Britain, and the high probability of an invasion by the German forces cannot be overemphasized. It really was on the cusp of happening. So all of these Polish forces came into the country at a time when the country itself was really bracing itself for what was a high expectation of invasion.
But you will know better than anybody else that to have a successful land or sea operation at this time, you don't need air superiority, you need air supremacy, i.e. nothing can take off or land. You need to have completely clear skies. And this is where, the Hitlerian spotlight comes on Goering, because Berlin gets bombed by the RAF in response for the early raids on Britain. And had Hitler not, had Goering not been told to concentrate on revenge bombings and hit the airfields, then it might have been a very different story whatsoever.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. And of course, it had huge influences. The Polish contingent of aircrew was relatively low in numbers. And there was a resistance for the RAF to embrace them as a corporately fit-for-purpose structure. So the Polish people, the Polish pilots and aircrew, got dispersed to various places. Many went northwards to consolidate their training. And those that were capable of flying the Spitfire were, I suppose the best phrase would be, sidelined from actually embarking in that, because the stiff upper lip of the RAF sort of process at that time was, we don't really want to engage with something we haven't got total control over, so we will go with what we've got, which is the iconic public schoolboy RAF officer,
yeah,
who most of which at that time came from a bit of a privileged background, who were very capable, competent pilots, but the structure would never last long with just them. So while all this was going on, there was a massive training program underway,
yeah,
to try to increase the capability, in particular of fighter command, who held the baton of defending the skies at that time.
You see, and that's the thing, because people think, oh, fighters, yeah, wonderful. But a fighter is a defensive aircraft. A bomber is an offensive aircraft. So you need, yes, fighters to ward off the bombers, and that's the whole thing. So it's not Spitfires swooping on Berlin and shooting stuff. You need a Lancaster over there.
You do. But of course, Giles, at that early point in the war, a lot of the bomber command aircraft were what would be classed as heavy bomber, but they were two-engined, yeah, bombers, which were quite removed from the iconic Lancaster and the Halifax.
Yeah.
They were pre-war concepts who were pretty precarious to fly all the way to Berlin on, because if you lost an engine, you've lost a crew and an aircraft, basically.
And also, you've not, until the Mustang comes on the scene, you've got nothing that can stay with you to Berlin. So you are, as you see from the RAF raids and the ball bearing raids in, you know, 1943, yeah, which is the killing time, if you like, if you've seen Masters of the Air, listeners, that is the period we're kind of talking about, where it was absolutely sort of a horrendous situation if you remember the American Army, yes, Air Force, yeah?
Yes. It was a long journey, Giles, between the capability of twin-engined basic pre-war bomber,
yeah,
to Bomber Command's infinite strength through four-engined heavy bomber Lancasters that could be escorted to maybe two-thirds of the distance and attack the central heart of Germany in the 43-44 period of time frames that, yeah, we talk about. There's a lot of conjecture from post-war critics who say the mass bombing was unnecessary, but the mass bombing was designed to disrupt and disable the mechanism of war being used by Germany, i.e. the massive infrastructure of factories and workforces that were producing tanks, artillery guns, aircraft, the whole mechanism of war. And it was impossible to precisely take out a factory.
Yeah.
You know, many factories were in big industrial rural areas. And you could look at it in several ways, but at the time, the jeopardy was so high that you have to bear that in mind.
I'm loving this conversation, but we're going away from our, because I could talk to you about that until the Sunday. Right then, but let's get back to our man, shall we? Because I mean, I was about to go off on a whole bomber command, yes, and hitting the German rail network, and then we'd be anyway. But anyway, so talking of the subject of this book. He gets himself into the air finally. He's very successful. He shoots down one of my favourite aircraft in the world, which is the Focke Wulf. And then it gets very interesting indeed, doesn't it?
Yes. He qualified as a fighter pilot. He was embraced into the RAF squadron network, and he flew alongside his fellow RAF pilots. He was successful. He attacked and damaged the Messerschmitt 109, a Junkers 88, and the Focke Wulf 190. And overall, you would look at those statistics and say he was a successful and capable Spitfire fighter pilot flying over occupied France and other territories in the war. However, the jeopardy of being a fighter pilot over occupied territory was always high. And if they should have a malfunction in their aircraft or be shot down, then ultimately they were, if they could fortunately escape by parachute, they were faced with a situation of always landing in occupied territory. And there was a very good network of German forces designed to capture and incarcerate those pilots so they couldn't get back to England and getting another aircraft and fight again. That was the basic principle of it. He got shot down. He got shot. His aircraft was disabled to some level, but he tried to make it back over the channel. Clearly, he had insufficient capability to do that. So he followed the coastline down towards Holland. And then I'm assuming he inverted the Spitfire, fell out of the cockpit, parachuted down. He had sustained some burns to his face, purely, I suppose, from an engine fire. That would be a conjecture point. And he landed close to a German anti-aircraft flak battalion who obviously saw to his injuries initially and was then a prisoner of war.
And so when he's a Polish RAF pilot, he ends up getting sent to would it be a normal sort of in the camp, because he ends up writing anti-Bolshevik propaganda. This gets really interesting.
The Luftwaffe, the German Air Force infrastructure, was anybody that became a prisoner of war that came from an Allied aircraft was seen as a source of intelligence. So they set up a Dulag interrogation camp, which was a short stay camp where everybody was transported to. They were interviewed, interrogated, assessed for their capability of either disclosing or not disclosing any information. And obviously, Poles were probably a little bit more focused upon than a British counterpart pilot. And through Julian Zoromsky's history, he was anti-Bolshevik, and he clearly made those feelings known to his interviewers. And he wrote and was quite happy to compose sort of anti-Bolshevik thoughts onto paper.
Because obviously the Gestapo or however the Nazi intelligence Abwehr are not big fans of the Poles, to put it mildly. I mean, if you're an RAF pilot, if you are one of those guys with a moustache and a pipe and a Labrador called Sandy at home, that's fine because you're British and the whole thing. If you're a Pole, let's not forget, the Nazi regime has told these people are untermenschen basically for years before. And so there's a very good chance they might have just been shot out of hand for being Poles.
That clearly did happen. In this instance, of course, it was a stage in the war where Russia's forces had aligned with the other Allied forces. So Russia was no longer an ally of the German forces, and any opportunity to gather propaganda in the propaganda war was, I think, swiftly welcomed by those that were imparted on the task of engaging in politics.
So is he still being held in a camp then, but in better circumstances than he would have been had he been somebody had fallen out of the back of a B-17 sort of situation?
Well, normally the transition through the interrogation camp would have been just a matter of a couple of days or so, because it would be evidence that there is nothing to be gained from this individual, and they would be transported by train off to a prisoner of war camp.
Yeah.
In the case of Julian Zoromsky, he appears to have been retained there longer than the average. And the layman's term would be, and the reference that I'm quite happy with, is that the Luftwaffe were turned him to their advantage by appeasing, obviously, his anti-Russian philosophy and engaged in the conversation that he was happy to have with them. This is not a conversation which is against Allied assets or Allied strategy. This was a personal affiliation that he had about his thoughts with the Russian forces. He was deemed to be pliable and of use to the system, and the powers that be then would take anybody who ticked those boxes actually to Berlin.
You see, the thing is, it's very easy to have this conversation, people saying, well, I wouldn't have done that. I would have taken, you know, I would never have given that information. Again, in the same way that people say, oh, well, we should never have had a civilian bombing campaign in the Second World War. It's very easy to do it now because we know what happens. But at the time, stay alive, neutralize your enemy. If, you know, he's not a lover of the Soviet Union because he knows what they're doing to Poland, and they will do to Poland in the Warsaw Uprising, etc. Stalin's a complete so-and-so. And the Poles basically get liquidated by both sides. So you can kind of understand where he's coming from. So how does he get out? And obviously, if he gets caught by the Soviets again, he's in very big trouble, and he's going to get. And also, there's a huge distrust by the system that the Soviets put into Poland, the new government, because they don't want the free Poles coming back in, do they?
Correct. Yeah, and you summarised that reasonably well, Giles. Because in effect, as a captured prisoner of war, there's always a philosophy of hoping you get to a camp where there's reasonable food and your welfare is going to be met. In the case of Julian Zoromsky, he was given the option of still being a captured Allied member of the armed forces, be it he was Polish, but he was still an RAF officer. And he was taken to a camp in Berlin, which had been specifically categorized for some people who may very well respond to a better environment, probably better food, probably better living conditions, and would reciprocate by being compliant with whatever the task was that they were deemed to be of use for. It must be said that they didn't take any, the German forces didn't take anybody there. It was selected individuals who were either totally compliant by saying, I don't believe in the war and, you know, I'll do whatever you want. But in the case of Julian Zoromsky, it was political. It was anti-Bolshevik capabilities of propaganda that they could use. And that's all it was.
You see, this is the thing. It's a really thin line he's skating between being a collaborator and being anti-Bolshevik. And the problem for him surely must be, Colin, that in the aftermath of the war, when it's all chaos and people coming in, you know, you and I can sit there and go, well, he was helping because he was his political convictions. But all it takes is somebody with a rifle going, well, you were working for the Nazis, boom. And that's, you know, and that's as the Americans would say, is game over, Colin.
Yes. Yes. And it's very easy to judge and be judgmental retrospectively when you've got sort of narrow parameters. But there is a much wider perspective of what was happening in Europe at that time.
Yeah.
And sometimes we forget that even in Germany, for instance, that there were orders that any German civilian going onto a bomb site and what we would term looting, but it could be just looking for some their own property, they actually committed an offence for which they were put before the German people's courts. And ultimately, many were executed because of a simple offence that was deemed to be unacceptable by the Germans at that time. So there were pressures everywhere on every facet of life. But more importantly, with Julian Zoromsky, he had fought for the Allies very, very hard.
I am going to run out of time, Colin. I could speak to you, but I've got a minute left before we crash the news. Listeners, go onto the TRE web, go onto the TRE website, TRE.radio. You'll see a picture of the book. If you click on that, the book will be winging its way to you via a well-known source by one. Colin, if people want to get in touch with you, obviously the first place per call is going to be the website. Just give out the website details, please.
Yes, it would be the World Wide Web, www.colinpateman.com.
Colin, it's been brilliant to speak to you. I want to get you back because I want to talk about tail gunners and all that sort of thing. But thank you. The book is called Spitfire Pilot, Flight Lieutenant Julian Zoromsky. It is by Colin Pateman, who is speaking today. Colin, as you can probably tell by the tone of my voice, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today.
Thank you very much. Bye, Jarvis.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right.